American Free Press Online Edition, 25 and 26, June 17 and 24, 2019. Riot Act raised, federal judge strikes down anti-riot acts as unconstitutional, due in part to efforts of fledgling Free Expression Foundation, by the AFP staff in a stinging defeat for the hard left and its media enablers and collaborators, and a momentous victory for constitutional liberty. On June 3, Federal District Court Judge Cormac Carney granted the defense motion to dismiss the indictment in the Justice Department's highly political prosecution in California of members of the Rise Above movement, RAM, under the Federal Anti-Riot Act. In a solidly reasoned opinion, Carney struck down the Anti-Riot Act as unconstitutional and ordered the defendant's immediate release. The RAM members, brought into the courtroom in shackles, were unshackled and walked away free men. While primary credit must go to the hard-working defense counsel, the Free Expression Foundation, FEF, played an important role, providing legal analysis to the defense and submitting an amicus curiae brief that Carney, over the government's opposition, accepted for filing. In short, right out of the gate, FEF has had a major victory for free speech for all Americans, as explained in a recent AFP article, April 8, 2019. The U.S. government's attempted revival of the long-dormant Anti-Riot Act poses a grave threat to Americans' First Amendment rights. The act improperly criminalizes mere intent alone, is in manifest discord with recent Supreme Court decisions, is flagrantly overbroad, and gives far too much discretion to the government to enforce it selectively on purely political grounds. And selective enforcement is precisely what happened in the RAM prosecutions. The government, bending to political pressure, averted its eyes from clear evidence that Antifa groups attacked and disrupted pro-Trump rallies in California and the Charlottesville Assembly. Of the hundreds of rowdy people at the rallies, only the 8 RAM members were charged by the government. Carney began his opinion by observing, "It is easy to champion free speech when it advocates a viewpoint with which we agree. It is much harder when the speech promotes ideas that we find abhorrent. But an essential function of free speech is to invite dispute. Speech may indeed best serve its high purpose when it induces a condition of unrest, creates dissatisfaction with conditions as they are, or even stirs people to anger." Terming Yellow v. City of Chicago, 337 U.S. 1, 4, 1949. Frequently, the public arena is the stage for these disputes. In the civil rights era, for instance, protesters took to the streets to contest segregation and Jim Crow. Today, people continue to take their message to the streets, advocating on hotly contested issues, whether it be abortion, Black Lives Matter, climate change, or health care. One person's protest might be another person's riot. Then, carefully analyzing the act, he noted, "The act covers far more than acts of violence. It also criminalizes activities that precede any violence and reaches speech and expressive conduct. No violence even need occur. A defendant could be convicted for renting a car with a credit card, posting about a political rally on Facebook, or texting friends about when to meet up." Carney then identified a critical failing of the act, in manifest discord with Brandenburg v. Ohio, 395 U.S. 444, 1969, and other Supreme Court precedents. "It does not require that advocacy be directed toward inciting or producing imminent lawless action." He further observed, "A riot is closely intertwined with political activity. A rioting crowd is often protesting the policies of a government, an employer, or some other institution, or the social fabric in general. A riot may well erupt out of an originally peaceful demonstration. The political nature of a riot increases the risk that the Anti-Riot Act criminalizes a substantial amount of protected expressive activity. To protect citizens' important rights of speech and assembly, courts must be wary of government attempts to censor a particular view, especially on the basis that certain ideas cause disturbances." New ideas, more often than not, create disturbances, and to this end, speech may best serve its high purpose. Attorneys Andrew Allen and Glenn Allen, who acted on behalf of FEF in this matter, were jubilant about the decision. "The act is flagrantly unconstitutional," Glenn Allen remarked, And the fact that the government invoked it against only RAM members and not Antifa calls into question the government's fairness and impartiality. Thank God there is still sufficient integrity in our judicial system to check such abuses. Glenn Allen also noted that the FBI and Justice Department relied heavily on reports from ProPublica and a Frontline documentary in preparing the indictment and ignored the more balanced HIFI report. Although the California RAM defendants are now free, the Charlottesville RAM defendants, unfortunately, remain in prison. Judge Norman K. Moon in the Charlottesville prosecution, in a prior decision on May 2, 2019, had upheld the constitutionality of the Anti-Riot Act, an easy way you can help us double subscribers. In the most recent issue of the Council Courier, the quarterly newsletter that goes out to all members of AFP's Readership Council, AFPRC, this editor detailed the state of the newspaper industry in the United States, and, not surprisingly, the picture that's painted is pretty grim. For those who don't know, the AFPRC is a group of AFP subscribers, who in return for paying $76 a year, which can be paid once a year or split quarterly or semi-annually, get an annual AFP subscription along with a special insider newsletter called the Council Courier and 10% off purchases of books and DVDs. It's a good program for people who are interested in more than just the news. They want to know about us and the organization, too, and are willing to pay just $17 more a year to do so. In the commentary, I quote from an Associated Press, AP, article from earlier this year that noted, all newspaper owners face a brutal reality that calls into question whether it's an economically sustainable model anymore, unless, like the Jeff Bezos-owned Washington Post, the boss is the world's richest man. They were getting eaten away at every level, said Ken Doctor, a news industry analyst at Harvard's Nieman Lab. Newspaper circulation in the U.S. has declined every year for three decades, while advertising revenue has nosedived since 2006. According to the Pew Research Center, staffing at newspapers large and small has followed a grim trend line. Pew says the number of reporters, editors, photographers, and other newsroom employees in the industry fell by 45% nationwide between 2004 and 2017. The broader point of the AP article was that local newspapers, once largely immune to declining circulation, have been hit hard the past few years just like the big media, as more and more people rely on the internet to get their local information. For what it's worth, it's not just newspapers that are struggling. Cable and internet news outlets have been floundering, too, evidenced by announcements of mass layoffs and buyouts at online media firms like Vice and Vox. Cable news giant CNN even announced recently that it was initiating a series of buyouts for hundreds of employees, a move corporations typically make in order to avoid the public relations disaster of having to fire large numbers of staff or declare bankruptcy. Perhaps worst of all was the recent sale of Salon.com, a liberal news and commentary website, once considered the most popular internet news source for liberals. The site, which still gets millions of views every month, recently sold for $5 million with the buyer required to make only a $500,000 down payment. You don't need a doctorate in business to know that the U.S. news industry is a dumpster fire. And where does America's last real national newspaper stand amidst all of this? As we've written many times before, the good news is American Free Press has zero debt, which means we aren't beholden to faceless shareholders, who are only interested in their pound of flesh, the return on their investment, and couldn't care less about whether they are getting the unbridled truth from their news source. Over the years, this has given us the breathing room to do what we've had to do in order to maintain our survival and invest in the future. That said, this newspaper has certainly not been immune to the wave of declining circulations plaguing the industry. One simple fact that cannot be ignored today is that the generation of print newspaper readers is aging and dying off. The unfortunate reality is, at some point in the next 10 years, American Free Press will have to either switch to an entirely new format that is cheaper to produce than newsprint or, worst case scenario, go digital, only as the cost of printing outpaces our subscriber base. But here's an easy solution. Our circulation troubles would be easily solved if every one of our readers could purchase a gift subscription for a friend or family member. See page 30 for more. If you don't know anyone who might be interested in AFP, you can always make a donation in the market for our circulation program. Multiple times throughout the year, our promotions department does special mailings to former subscribers and other like-minded individuals. As of this moment, we at American Free Press have every intention to keep publishing well into the future. But please keep all this in mind the next time you're up for renewal. We have plenty of options available. Feel free to call me or anyone on our staff to inquire about how you can help keep us going for the next generation. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor. People Revolt Against NWO Mass Immigration. Failure of Globalism Behind Europe's Recent Nationalist Resurgence. By John Friend. Nationalists and populists across Europe made tremendous gains in the recent European Union, EU, elections, demonstrating the appeal of these highly demonized political ideologies in an era of economic and political globalization, massive third world immigration to the continent, and an increasingly out-of-touch elite political class ruling in Brussels determined to push European integration at all costs. Even traditionally left-wing parties, such as the Social Democrats in Denmark, have taken a more populist approach on issues like immigration. Mette Frederiksen, the 41-year-old leader of Denmark's Social Democrats, whose party recently won 25.9% of the vote in Danish elections, has increasingly pushed her party to the right on the key issue of massive third world migration into Europe, a top issue for many Danish voters. Frederiksen has addressed the issue in more traditionally left-wing terms, arguing that globalization and massive immigration have harmed the middle and working classes of Denmark and other European nations. For me, it is becoming increasingly clear that the price of unregulated globalization, mass immigration, and the free movement of labor is paid for by the lower classes, Frederiksen stated in a recent biography. Frederiksen's Social Democrats have long played a key role in Danish politics, working with more right-leaning parties, including the Danish People's Party, which is seen by many as the most far-right party in the country, on key issues such as immigration. The Social Democrats in Denmark have supported policies that crack down on refugee resettlement and unchecked migration, positions the traditionally left-leaning party formerly opposed. Frederiksen has argued that SD parties in other European countries must adopt a more hardline stance on immigration, which poses a major threat to their traditional voter base, middle and working class Europeans. For years, we have underestimated the challenges of mass immigration, Frederiksen argued at a meeting of Social Democrat parties around Europe late last year. Economic policy and foreign policy in Europe have been too liberal. We have failed when it comes to maintaining the social contract, which is the very foundation of the social, democratic social model. The positions on immigration taken by Frederiksen and other populists across Europe stand in stark contrast to the elites in Brussels, who view massive immigration and spurting diversity as moral imperatives that must be championed and implemented across the continent. Outgoing European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, epitomizing the mindset of the nation-wrecking globalist elites that have largely dominated the European Union and broader project of European integration, harshly criticized the various populist and nationalist movements and leaders that have come to the fore of European politics, particularly in recent years as Euroscepticism has risen across the continent. These populists, nationalists, stupid nationalists, they are in love with their own country, and they don't like the others, Juncker arrogantly and dismissively stated in an interview with CNN shortly before the recent European elections. In some countries of the European Union, the government, parliament, major parts of society, don't like those coming from far away. Either like those coming from far away, because the main guiding principle of the European Union should be solidarity. We have to act in solidarity with those who are in worse situations than we are. Many Europeans are beginning to view the suicidal mindset of Juncker and other EU elites as entirely contrary to the interests of their respective nation-states, which have seen massive third-world immigration, rising crime and instability, and a total failure on the part of European Union. institutions and governments in actually integrating the various newcomers into the EU. Many European nations, such as France, Germany, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, have seen a tremendous influx of so-called refugees, asylum seekers, and other third world immigrants, resulting in protracted cultural, social, and economic problems across the continent. The so-called new Europeans have largely failed to successfully integrate into European society, preferring instead to cling to their national and ethnic identities, which has contributed to the polarization of society, a fact political leaders like Fredrickson have long recognized. In my eyes, it is neither heroic nor humane to bring so many people here that the problems become huge in our own country, the leader of Denmark's Social Democrats declared before the 2015 election. Because we're not very good at integrating in Denmark, and there's nothing to indicate that we're going to get better. In Italy, the small town of Rias in the southern province of Calabria recently elected a right-wing government after having been dominated by radical leftists for years. The town, long known as a global village whose former political leadership openly welcomed migrants, took in hundreds of refugees and other third world migrants in recent years, sparking a backlash following reported allegations of corruption, fraud, and unrest among the migrant population. The problem is that we had too many migrants and we lost the spirit of openness there was initially. Antonio Trifoli, the newly elected mayor and former town policeman, stated in a recent interview. Trifoli is affiliated with Italian populist Matteo Salvini and his Lega Nord party, which has seen a dramatic increase in popularity and political clout in recent elections. A whole economic system developed with the migrants, but without making the village dynamic again, Trifoli said. The model destroyed itself. The clash between globalism and populism continues on the European continent, and at this point, it's safe to say populism is on the rise, largely because of the disastrous effects of globalism. Bilderberg Insider's shocking admission. Club of Rome founder admitted that global warming is a hoax cooked up to scare public, by Mark Anderson in the early 1980s. Justin Walker was an idealistic, hard-working member of the British Green Party when, upon being invited to lunch by an apparent fellow idealist who also was a well-connected Fiat Motors executive, he heard firsthand that dire claims of impending environmental doom were being fabricated to deliberately instill widespread insecurity, so the overall population could be goaded into world government. Walker's uncle by marriage was Sir Harry Pilkington, a participant at the very first Bilderberg meeting in Holland in 1954, representing the Federation of British Industries. Pilkington in 1955 became a director of the Bank of England, a position he held until 1972, Walker told AFP. In an interview just after Bilderberg's 67th meeting this year in Switzerland, my own personal experience has shown me that the green movement is now totally corrupt and totally without any real solutions or meaning for the human race, Walker added. He recalled that, when he joined the green movement in 1978, most of the party members tried to be an anti-party party, to distance themselves from conventional party politics, in the belief they actually stood for something and would not let the world's corporate power brokers push them around. Pilkington, described as a devoted environmental conservationist, in 1980 gave Walker his personal copy of a book called The World Conservation Strategy. I was very impressed by that because I was in the Green Party, and I felt this is the real way forward for politics, Walker recalled. And then I read another book called 100 Pages for the Future by a man named Aurelio Pexley, who was a senior executive at Fiat Motor Company in Italy, but he also co-founded the Club of Rome, the organization that's behind most of the elite interests in the environment, including, of course, man-made global warming. Citing the pivotal experience with a Fiat industrialist, Walker continued, in 1982 I wrote to Aurelio Pexley, and he said, come and see me, have lunch with me. Unknown to me, my uncle had also approached him because he knew my uncle. Well, I was having lunch with Pexley and he suddenly offered me a job to go and work as one of his researchers for the Club of Rome. He then said to me, and these were his exact words that I remember so clearly, you'll be joining us at a very exciting time. We are creating a global environmental problem that's going to frighten people into wanting global government. At the time, Walker said, being a green politician, I thought this was wonderful. I didn't know the facts about Bill Derberg, because this was before, British conspiracy researcher, David Icke, also a former Green Party member, started doing his research and other people started doing their research, to show that there's a hidden tier of government above our elected governments. Walker added that, up until 1982, nobody mentioned man-made global warming. If anything, they were talking about a mini ice age, and they were talking about acid rain. This was obviously when they started to get the idea that they could latch onto global warming. Walker confessed, I considered going to work for PEXI for about a week, but I worked for my father at the time, and I was in the Territorial Army and had just been promoted to captain. I had a new girlfriend, and I was in the Green Party and thought I was going to get elected to Parliament. Pilkington died the next year in 1983, and PEXI died in 1984. Pilkington, late in his life, would tell Walker not to believe the press because we control it, referring to the Bilderberg clique, and soon the independent researchers who found increasing evidence of a hidden tier of government that regulated the political process convinced Walker that declining the job was the right decision. Nowadays, Walker leads the new Chartist movement to mainly focus on denying the banking power its illicit control of the medium of exchange. My main interest is the money supply and the fact that how much money the world has to spend is dependent on a handful of private individuals and dynastic families, stemming to this one organization, the Bank for International Settlements, the central bank of the central banks in Basel, Switzerland, thought to be the ultimate banking nerve center. Big media covers for Bilderberg globalists want Silicon Valley's help on censorship, election fixing, new war tech. By Mark Anderson. Several ironies and surprises surround the 2019 Bilderberg conference that ran May 30 June 2 in Montreux, Switzerland, not the least of which were reasonably substantial reports in two of America's leading members of the mass media cartel, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Why all the fuss from media giants that usually downplay or ignore Bilderberg? Well, the big media's favorite target, President Donald Trump, sent his chief advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Bilderberg, along with several National Security Council and Office of the Secretary of Defense personnel, not to mention the attendance of possible Democratic presidential candidate Stacey Abrams, the radical black leftist attorney who lost her bid for Georgia's governorship. The Times noted in a May 31 piece, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on a week-long trip to Europe where he is raising sensitive issues with national leaders, from Iranian missiles to Chinese technology to the economic collapse of Venezuela, but the most colorful conversations could take place this weekend out of public earshot in a secretive conclave at a Swiss lakeside resort. It didn't seem to occur to the Times that perhaps such sensitive matters shouldn't even be discussed at Bilderberg, whose participants, representing a broad spectrum of government and corporate power, could have unknown personal connections and may leak sensitive information about U.S. national security, a key problem with Bilderberg to begin with. At any rate, the Times called Bilderberg's 67th meeting in 65 years an annual forum in which participants agree not to reveal exactly what was said or who said it. It is a shadow version of Davos, the elite annual winter conference in the Swiss Alps that President Trump has attended once but has also criticized. While that last passage could almost be mistaken for the late AFP Bilderberg hound Jim Tucker's writings, what the Times didn't disclose is that another Times reporter, renowned national security writer David E. Sanger, was already inside Bilderberg as a listed participant. The Times's duplicity was matched by the Post, while prose writer Adam Taylor scribbled a screed that combined poking fun at Bilderberg's critics with tidbits of real reporting. He pled ignorance about what Bilderberg might ultimately be discussing, to wit, the involvement of key Trump administration members may spark criticism from those who view the meetings as nefarious gatherings of the global elite, conspiracy theorists, including a number who have publicly supported Trump, have picketed the event in recent years. The meeting's website lists topics for discussion this year, including China, Russia, Brexit and climate change and sustainability. One thing not listed, however, is the topic that is apparently driving Pompeo's visit to Europe, Iran, which the Trump administration claims poses a growing threat. Could the world's power brokers end up discussing Iran anyway? Perhaps, but it's unlikely that we'll ever know. Really, Taylor could simply huddle with fellow post-writer Megan McArdle, who joined Sanger inside Bilderberg, and the Bilderberger's famed Chatham House rule needn't be an obstacle. The Post's intrepid reporters certainly could pump Megan for information and dodge the rule. Meanwhile, the alternative press on the ground endured very trying circumstances. Dandix of Press for Truth, Luke Rutkowski of We Are Change, and Glenn Bolton of the Conspiracy Cabbie were detained at the Geneva airport while photographing and questioning Stone Cold Silent invitees to the Bilderberg meeting. They did spot former Google CEO Eric Schmidt as he strolled outside the Bilderberg meeting to ask him whether Bilderberg has had anything to do with deplatforming online conservative constitutional commentators, with nerdy Schmidt brusquely brushing off the questions. Yet these hard-working reporters were the ones being questioned by police, who politely searched the reporters several times. Dix remarked that freedom of the press seems to nosedive whenever Bilderberg is in town. Guardian reporter Charlie Skelton, whose annual writings on Bilderberg extended to Newsweek Online this year, walks the fine line between mainstream and alternative reporting on Bilderberg. In a witty and in many ways insightful Newsweek piece, he noted, "As the war machine gets smarter, and every last bit of weaponry becomes AI-enhanced, the lines between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon start to blur. Sniff this year's Bilderberg and you can smell this new kind of war. Cyber threats and the weaponization of social media on the agenda. This blurring of tech and war takes physical form in some of the participants at Bilderberg." Longtime conference insider and former Google CEO Eric Schmidt chairs the Pentagon's Defense Innovation Board and also heads up the new National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. Two other members of the Defense Innovation Board are Hiran Montrer, Reid Hoffman, of LinkedIn, and psychologist Adam M. Grant. Alongside Schmidt on the Bilderberg Steering Committee are two more tech billionaires, Alex Karp and Peter Thiel. Karp is the CEO of Palantir, a shady data analytics company which has just won a massive $800 million Pentagon battlefield intelligence contract. Palantir was set up in 2004 by Peter Thiel with backing from the CIA. Those are some interesting observations, but consider some highlights of the greater Bilderberg network that often are overlooked by both mainstream and alternative media. 2019 Bilderberg attendee Fernando Medina, the mayor of Lisbon, flew immediately from Switzerland to attend the Pritzker Forum on Global Cities in Chicago June 5 to 7, where the elevation of municipal power to the global level to sidestep the nation-state was the central theme. That forum, which sees the global cities movement as a means of countering the populist uprising that Bilderberg fears, included a presentation on resilient cities, a Rockefeller Foundation backed project that involves technological input from Karp's Palantir firm. The Trilateral Commission, the younger and somewhat more open Bilderberg sibling which in many ways makes Bilderberg's dealings more visible, for the first time ever held its annual North American regional meeting in Silicon Valley, California, November 16, 17, 2018. Interestingly, the Trilateral's European regional meeting held the same month included Canadian anti-PC psychology professor Jordan Peterson as one of its speakers, addressing a provocation, "Will liberal democracy survive?" That meeting also included 2019 Bilderberg participant José Manuel Barroso, former European Commission president, and 2019 Bilderberg attendee Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella is partnering with two highly suspect companies, NewsGuard and ElectionGuard, to police cyberspace for fake news and retool our election machinery to make elections more accountable, even while NewsGuard, which involves using real editors instead of computer algorithms to weed out suspected disinformation, has advisory board members and investors tied to Bilderberg, the CIA, CNN, and the Global Cities Movement. The reality is that today's Bilderberg is just one of several groupings within a network that constitutes a powerful privateer of government, and the network's architects are pressing onward, despite being at an apparent crossroads. The Trilateral Commission's 2019 plenary meeting took place June 14 to 16 in Paris, and the Commission's next European meeting will be November 22 to 24 in Stockholm, Sweden. If Julian Assange, WikiLeaks lose, journalism may never recover. By St. Patrick, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is starting to rack up some small victories that may have big cumulative results. Though the question of whether or not he can maneuver from beneath the great legal behemoth of U.S. law is still yet to be determined. All well and good that he is achieving at least some positive results, as WikiLeaks has been a valuable contributor to the field of journalism and the most vital entity forcing government transparency in the digital age. In May, the UN's special reporter on torture, Niels Melzer, issued a statement clearly chastising the United States, Great Britain, Ecuador, and Sweden for their treatment of Assange. The public rebuke of those nations against Assange has been a breath of fresh air to observers who clearly see the freedom-disparaging precedents that any Assange prosecution would set. Melzer summed up what the WikiLeaks founder has experienced for nearly a decade. In the course of the past 9 years, Melzer continued, Mr. Assange has been exposed to persistent, progressively severe abuse ranging from systematic judicial persecution and arbitrary confinement in the Ecuadorian embassy, to his oppressive isolation, harassment, and surveillance inside the embassy, and from deliberate collective ridicule, insults, and humiliation to open instigation of violence and even repeated calls for his assassination. In early June, Swedish courts declined to issue an arrest warrant for Assange, 8 years after the European arrest warrant was believed to have been issued. Seeking a new warrant against Assange, Swedish prosecutors failed to get the expected rubber stamp. Rather, the court said that an issuance would be disproportionate. This is a blow to many leftists in the UK and the US, who so desperately wanted Assange to have rapist permanently embedded next to a bullet point on his bio. Some leftists hate Assange, believing that he and WikiLeaks worked with Donald Trump to undermine the presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton. Now that there's no arrest warrant from Sweden, there is also no extradition warrant from there, either. Regarding Sweden, Assange's record is hereby clean. The mainstream media's tirades against Assange have been perplexing and self-serving. While they have been using Assange's more disorganized, less rote collection of whistleblowers as stories and sources of stories for over a decade, they are now using Assange and WikiLeaks as a means by which they can delineate between real journalists and mere leakers. There has been no acknowledgement of the changing face of journalism, the dwindling importance and viewership of the mainstream, and, more importantly, the governmental accountability that WikiLeaks has forced. Since publishing its first document in 2006, a signed decision by a Somali sheikh to assassinate government officials, WikiLeaks has released over 10 million documents. In their first 2 years alone, WikiLeaks exposed the daily protocol of the U.S. Army at Guantanamo Bay, that some Gitmo prisoners were off-limits to the Red Cross, the illegal activities of banks in the Cayman Islands, the secret Bibles of Scientology, the contents of Sarah Palin's Yahoo email account, hacked by the group Anonymous, and a list of members in the British National Party. WikiLeaks was never accused of being a tool of the American political right or any of its politicians then. That is a new delusion perpetrated by angry partisans. WikiLeaks was valuable and trusted through the final Bush years and even more so during the presidency of Barack Obama when it exposed the war crimes of the U.S. military. In February 2010, WikiLeaks began publishing documents sourced from Army Private Bradley, Chelsea, Manning. The most notable was the collateral murder video of a 2007 airstrike in Baghdad that resulted in the killing of two Reuters reporters by U.S. pilots who mistakenly thought they were carrying weapons. What turned Assange, unfairly, into a partisan figure was the 2016 release of 1,258 emails from a personal server illegally kept in the home of then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Also released were 20,000 emails and 8,000 documents from the Democratic National Committee. many of which showed a concerted internal campaign against Bernie Sanders and in favor of Clinton, are the employees and volunteers of WikiLeaks journalists. They've won The Economist New Media Award, Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the Sam Adams Award for Integrity, the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, the Voltaire Award for Free Speech, and a variety of journalism awards in Brazil, Kazakhstan, Italy, and the U.S. WikiLeaks was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for 6 consecutive years, 2010 to 2015. Today, its founder sits in jail for exposing financial abuses, human rights abuses, and war crimes. LA faces historic crisis. By John Friend. Homelessness has long been a major problem in California, the most populous state in the Union, which ironically boasts one of the nation's largest and most robust economies yet has the highest poverty rate. In recent years, however, it has become increasingly clear that the homelessness problem in major California cities, particularly the Los Angeles metropolitan area, is a full-blown crisis that is threatening public health and sanitation in a way perhaps never seen before. Homelessness, poverty, and staggering income disparities, common features of third world countries, are on full display in major cities in California such as Los Angeles, San Diego, and San Francisco. According to a recent homelessness survey conducted annually in Los Angeles County, roughly 59,000 people are living without shelter across the most populous county in the country on a daily basis. That number is up from just under 53,000 in last year's survey, despite an increase in taxpayer-supported funding for public assistance aimed at combating homelessness. At this point of unprecedented wealth in the county of Los Angeles, we are equally confronted with unprecedented poverty manifesting itself in the form of homelessness, County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas recently told the Los Angeles Times. Last year's count, we felt we were trimming in a way that would suggest we were getting our arms around this. And yet this year we are pretty well stunned by this data. Homeless encampments can be found across Los Angeles County under freeways and overpasses, in public parks and wooded areas, and along the sidewalks of downtown Los Angeles and other major cities in the county. Trash, discarded furniture and other large household items, and piles of rubbish, debris, and human waste litter the city, as garbage and sanitation crews struggle to keep up with the waste. In certain areas of downtown Los Angeles, entire city streets have been consumed with trash, feces, and other debris, some of which is illegally dumped by local businesses and industrial facilities. The city of Los Angeles has become a giant trash receptacle, Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez recently wrote, arguing that residents are witnessing the collapse of a city that's lost control. Heaps of trash, debris, discarded items, and other waste are common features in Los Angeles, particularly in the downtown area. Skid Row, a notorious section of downtown known for its large homeless population, and surrounding areas are in some cases literally covered in garbage and waste, with countless homeless individuals camping and sleeping on the street. The piles of trash and waste are magnets for fleas, flies, rats, and other rodents, leaving area residents fearful for their health and well-being and that of their family and neighbors. I can't walk down the street without thinking that a flea could jump on me, Estela Lopez, who works downtown, told NBC4 Los Angeles recently. Many fear a public health crisis is underway, with diseases such as tuberculosis, typhus, and other contagious diseases common to third world countries showing up in California. Our homeless crisis is increasingly becoming a public health crisis, California Governor Gavin Newsom declared in his State of the Union address earlier this year. Typhus, a medieval disease, in California, in 2019, disease is spreading largely due to the homeless crisis, as the garbage attracts disease-spreading vermin. Not only do those struggling with homelessness lack basic shelter and sanitary living conditions, but they also lack reliable access to health services, restrooms and regular showers. Janice Hahn, who sits on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, stated that area residents are seeing more encampments, more people sleeping on the sidewalks in dirty, unhealthy, and heartbreaking conditions. They are frustrated by this problem. She declared, "We need to give people answers. Unfortunately, answers and solutions to the homeless crisis are difficult to come by, despite increasing levels of public and private money being directed at tackling the problem." Measure H, an initiative passed by Los Angeles voters in 2017 that added a quarter cent to local sales taxes to fund programs designed to address the homelessness crisis, has raised close to $400 million annually, yet the situation only seems to be spreading. Many argue the driving force is housing affordability. California has some of the highest real estate prices in the country, and modest apartments or townhouses are often exceedingly expensive even for working households. Additionally, substance abuse, mental illness, and other social problems exacerbate the crisis, with many living on the streets addicted to drugs or alcohol and seemingly uninterested in rehabilitation. This reporter is a resident of Los Angeles County, and can personally testify that the situation is out of control and shows no signs of abating. Cleaning up the county will be a major task for any elected official, and will no doubt require a joint public-private partnership to ensure lasting results. YouTube Inquisitors Demolish History, by Dr. Kevin Barrett. During the first week of June, YouTube announced a draconian new censorship policy, and immediately erased or demonetized the work of countless video makers, destroying thousands of livelihoods in the process. Conservatives bore the brunt of the onslaught. The new policy was unveiled in the wake of a highly publicized spat between conservative YouTuber Steven Crowder and Vice News commentator Carlos Meza, in which Meza accused Crowder of bullying and homophobia, though justified by liberal Silicon Valley oligarchs as a response to the racism, sexism, and homophobia of the alt-right. YouTube's new censorship plan begins with garden variety political correctness, and ends in the wholesale falsification of history. In a June 5 blog post announcing the new policy, YouTube wrote, "Today, we're taking another step in our hate speech policy by specifically prohibiting videos alleging that a group is superior in order to justify discrimination, segregation or exclusion based on qualities like age, gender, race, caste, religion, sexual orientation or veteran status. This would include, for example, videos that promote or glorify Nazi ideology, which is inherently discriminatory. Finally, we will remove content denying that well-documented violent events, like the Holocaust or the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, took place." The first two sentences sound like a well-meaning but maddeningly muddled mishmash of liberal platitudes. Taken at face value, YouTube is telling us we cannot allege that adults are intellectually superior to children and that children should therefore be segregated or excluded from busy streets, or that 20-year-olds are more physically vigorous than retirees and should be excluded from over 60 basketball leagues, age discrimination, or that men are physically stronger than women and should therefore be excluded from women's athletics, gender discrimination, and LGBT discrimination, or that poorer people and groups, being in general less capable in intellectual and practical matters than wealthier people and groups, should be given various advantages like free college tuition as part of a policy of reducing inequality, race and caste discrimination, or that veterans, having been willing to risk their lives for their country, deserve special benefits, pro-veterans discrimination." While the first two sentences of YouTube's new policy are unintentionally humorous, veterans, really, there is nothing remotely funny about the next, "Finally, we will remove content denying that well-documented violent events, like the Holocaust or the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, took place." This statement, framed in such a way as to make it sound acceptable to the misinformed multitudes, is truly Orwellian. History is a human construction. It is inherently fallible. It is constantly being revised on the basis of new evidence and interpretations, and the statement includes mention of literally millions of violent events, a great many of which are well documented, in the sense that there are plenty of documents available relating to any given event. What YouTube apparently doesn't understand is that virtually all violent and nonviolent events in history are documented in complex and contradictory ways and can be interpreted from a wide variety of perspectives. So how does all that evidence, and all those interpretive perspectives, get narrowed down to a relatively simple narrative about what supposedly happened in a given event. We like to imagine that smart, objective historians sift through evidence and argue about the most plausible interpretations. That is the ideal. Reality is closer to the old adage, history is written by the victors, the most powerful people and groups wield various carrots and sticks, forcing the vast majority of historians to consciously or unconsciously toe the official line. The powerless, and their versions of events, are reviled, misconstrued, or consigned to the proverbial memory hole. Left-wing historians once knew this and openly admitted it. In fact, while I was doing graduate work during the postmodernist-dominated 1990s, they actually exaggerated the degree to which truth is unknowable and history is just a myth inflicted by the powerful on the powerless. But then came 9/11, which was designed by people like Philip Zelikow, a self-proclaimed specialist in the creation and maintenance of public myths. 9/11 was a scripted and staged human sacrifice event of the kind studied by ethnologist René Guénon. Part of its purpose was to remythologize history, so the common people could once again be force-fed noble lies. In medieval Europe, if you denied the official version of certain mythic violent events, the crucifixion, the Cathar genocide, or even the Inquisition itself, you could be tortured and burned at the stake. With the Enlightenment came the modern discipline of history, which, fallible as it is, offers a better path to truth, the path of absolutely free and fearless debate. In the wake of the mythic big lie of 9/11, the Enlightenment has been revoked. YouTube is killing heretics by destroying their livelihoods. Internet censorship is today's Inquisition. Author discusses latest blockbuster, Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics 1776-1963. Donald Jeffries reveals the history they didn't teach you in school. By the AFP staff, the explosive new book Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics 1776-1963, The History They Didn't Teach You in School, which features a foreword from Ron Paul, tears the lid off two centuries worth of lies by the state-controlled court historians. In the words of the great George Orwell, who controls the past controls the future, who controls the present controls the past. Few Americans realize how far removed our present-day leaders are philosophically from the founding fathers and the system of government they carefully devised. Once revered figures like Thomas Jefferson have been slandered and branded racist by virtue signaling mainstream journalists and arrogant college professors. In his new book, Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776-1963, AFP writer Donald Jeffries takes an in-depth look at numerous subjects spanning two centuries of U.S. history. These topics include, for instance, evidence showing DNA tests that allegedly established Thomas Jefferson fathered the children of his slave Sally Hemings were less than complete. In fact, they merely demonstrated that a male from the Jefferson family, with over 20 potential candidates, probably fathered one of Hemings's children. While the author of the Declaration of Independence continues to be slurred as a child molester and rapist, the DNA tests actually proved that he could not have fathered the child who was born to Hemings when she was underage. Jeffries also writes that Hollywood has never made a film, even in its early, patriotic days, about the life of George Washington, or Benjamin Franklin, or Thomas Jefferson, or Patrick Henry. The only founding father who was given his own film was The Banker's Favorite, and the father of debt, Alexander Hamilton. While the other founders are dismissed now as dead, white men, Hamilton has experienced a rebirth on Broadway as a hip, young black man. The entertainment industry does not want to focus on the circumstances surrounding the birth of this republic and all that radical talk about overthrowing tyranny, taxation without representation, and the right of people everywhere to have a government they consent to. Readers will learn how the concept of consent of the governed was shattered forever by Abraham Lincoln during the war between the states. Crimes and Cover-ups exposes the dark side of Lincoln, revealing him to be a constitutional usurper, the first imperial president, and the greatest tyrant in the history of this country. Lincoln locked up an unknown number of civilians in the North for their opposition to the war or to his suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. One of those imprisoned was Frank T. Howard, grandson of Francis Scott Key. In a fantastic historical irony, Howard was jailed in Fort McHenry, the same fort over which the majestic flag was flying when his grandfather described it in the Star Spangled Banner. Lincoln also shut down more than 300 newspapers that dared to question his authority. He was even going to arrest the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who ruled that his suspension of the writ was unconstitutional, but his aides talked him out of it. While Lincoln forever altered the balance of powers with his overreach, readers should come to understand that his assassination was the result of an inside job, orchestrated almost certainly by his mentally unstable Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, William T. Sherman, Philip Sheridan, Ulysses S. Grant, and other Northern generals are exposed for what they were: bloodthirsty thugs who trampled upon the time-honored protocols of warfare. Under Lincoln, the scorched earth policy of Sherman and his cohorts resulted in the wholesale burning of houses and crops, destruction of land, organized plunder and theft, and unfettered rape of women, especially slave women. Readers will see Reconstruction for what it was: a military occupation of the South, with total subjugation of the remaining populace, which eventually resulted in the birth of the Ku Klux Klan, Jim Crow laws, and a century of separate but equal society. Other topics Jeffries explores include questions surrounding the assassinations of Presidents Garfield and McKinley, the false flag Remember the Maine incident, which ushered in America's first foray into truly international conflict, contradicting the isolationist common sense advice in George Washington's farewell address, World War I and the inexcusable, incomprehensible bloodbath it represented, the great general, Smedley Butler, whose little book War's a Racket still resonates today, President Woodrow Wilson's unconstitutional acts, made possible by the awful precedent set by Lincoln, the Treaty of Versailles, which set onerous restrictions on Germany, created payments of reparations to the victors that didn't stop until 2010, and made World War II inevitable, Adolf Hitler's rise to power, which was not accidental, as was documented in Anthony Sutton's classic book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, the stock market collapse and the Great Depression, which were created by the same bankers who became so empowered by the creation of the Federal Reserve System, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, Bruno Richard Hauptmann, an innocent victim of circumstances and a burgeoning anti-German prejudice, whose execution was state-sanctioned murder. More specifically, when it comes to the era of World War II, readers will learn that President Franklin D. Roosevelt's reign of terror was second only to Lincoln's, as he trampled upon the Constitution with impunity, with the lowlight being his largely forgotten Supreme Court packing scheme. Roosevelt, like Wilson, his cousin Teddy, high-profile lawyer Clarence Darrow, and other leading liberals of the era had all been passionately in support of World War I. Unlike genuine classical liberals and populists like William Jennings Bryan, Huey Long, and Smedley Butler, and were lusting for World War II, this book presents voluminous evidence that FDR and other high-ranking government officials were desperate to get into the new European war and engineered the sneak attack by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. And then there were the atrocities committed by the good guy allies, including widespread reports of rape, the bombing of Dresden, one of the most beautiful and historic cities in the world, which held no military importance whatsoever, was a war crime if ever there was such a thing. One of the last great American writers, Kurt Vonnegut, was inspired by the carnage at Dresden to write the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five about his experiences. The Nuremberg trials have become accepted as the ultimate justice by everyone across the political spectrum. Readers will learn, however, that there was great criticism of the trials at the time, especially from true liberals. Supreme Court Justice William R. Douglas and Senator Robert Taft were two of the leading voices of opposition. Then Senator John F. Kennedy used Taft's opposition to the Nuremberg trials as one of the chapters in his best-selling book Profiles in Courage. Young Kennedy himself left some choice critical comments on the record about this new brand of justice. A precedent for this had been set after the Civil War, when a federal government bent on vengeance executed Henry Wirz, the commander of the Andersonville prison, Camp Sumter, in the South for the deaths of thousands of Union prisoners of war. Even though it was impossible to feed northern prisoners adequately when food was scarce even for the southerners themselves, few Americans know that the South tried repeatedly to prod Grant and others to swap prisoners, because they knew they couldn't feed them. The South grew so desperate that they offered to release their prisoners without getting any back in return but were refused by the North. An actual attempt to drop northern prisoners off into the custody of northern officials in Florida was turned away at gunpoint. Punishing the losers in a war legally, and even with a death sentence, was not an entirely new thing in American history. While some Nazis were executed, and peace advocate Rudolf Hess became the solitary prisoner for decades at Spandau Prison, others were welcomed warmly into America under the CIA's Operation Paperclip program, whereby some helped establish the space program. Jeffries also examines the first and only congressional investigation into tax-free foundations, along with the impressions of Norman Dodd, chief investigator in 1953 for the Select Committee to Investigate Tax-Exempt Foundations and Comparable Organizations, a century's worth of hideous experiments performed on mental patients, prisoners, orphans, and soldiers, and impoverished communities are documented. Brainwashing and Manchurian candidate-style research conducted by the CIA are revealed, along with the hideous spraying of poisons and diseases into whole American communities by the military. Finally, the crusade to establish a one-world government, from Wilson's dream of the League of Nations, to the birth of the United Nations, is chronicled. Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776-1963, reminds the reader, over and over again, that history is written by the victors. History is also, as Napoleon Bonaparte said, merely a fable that is agreed upon. The court historians have distorted the record so thoroughly that most of the heroes it touts were genuine bad guys, and those labeled as villains were often the good guys, lifelong warmongers like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and other leading liberals of each age are portrayed as voices for peace and reason. A good American like Henry Ford, meanwhile, who was a genuine pacifist, is denigrated as a cranky anti-Semite. Most Americans have little interest in history, and a large number are historically illiterate. This book can help educate them. 5 Reasons to Fire Bolton Trump Should Send His Warmongering National Security Advisor Packing, by St. Patrick. John Bolton has proven that there still exists in politics the place where the absurd would be comical if it were not so dangerous. His newly created label for international supervillainy, the Troika of Tyranny, once again illustrates why Bolton should be fired from his position as National Security Advisor. Bolton is a danger to the safety and security of the nation he has pledged to protect. The 1964 political satire Dr. Strangelove parodied the war hawks that continually beat the drums of battle in an effort to enrich the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower created and then criticized. Those were the days of Generals LeMay, Lemnitzer, and Taylor, all dangers to anyone desiring a peaceful post-World War II existence. The 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall changed that and ended the reactionary tendencies of Cold War tensions, or so it was thought. The globalist interventionists who ushered in President George H.W. Bush's New World Order have directed foreign policy since 9/11. Bolton is chief among those still active in politics. There are valid reasons to demand that President Donald Trump fire Bolton before he completely derails any hope Trump had of making America great again, at least internationally. 1. The Troika of Tyranny. As if the administration hadn't stretched the interventionism strategy thin enough, Bolton looked southward to trump up new battlefields in Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. This troika of tyranny is no more serious than George W. Bush's Axis of Evil, Ronald Reagan's Evil Empire, or Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain. Before billions of dollars can be poured into covert coup d'états, Pentagon propaganda, and fruitless exercises of military might, the targets must be set up as boogeymen out to ruin the American way of life too. The itch to bomb Iran and North Korea. Bolton was Dick Cheney's first choice when the UN ambassadorship became available in 2005 because Bolton favored swift military action in Iran. He has never wavered on that position and has long favored preemptive strikes against both Iran and North Korea. 3. a terrorist around every corner, in Bolton's world, every country disagreeable with U.S. foreign and economic policy is a terrorist state in need of toppling, from Bolton's Troika to Iran, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, nations looking to guide their futures independently without American coercion, are breeding grounds for terrorism, which, today, means nations tired of seeing Americans with guns pointed at them in their own countries. 4. A bully Trump can respect. José Bustany, a Brazilian diplomat, was once the head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. In 2001, Bustany received a thank you note from Secretary of State Colin Powell for negotiating a deal with Saddam Hussein to allow OPCW weapons inspectors into Iraq. The problem was that nuclear danger and the refusal of inspectors were the pretexts on which the Bush administration's hopes for war were pinned. In 2002, 1 year before the American invasion of Iraq, Bolton was sent to The Hague to speak with Bustany, who had been unanimously re-elected to his OPCW post. "Cheney wants you out," Bolton told Bustany. "We can't accept your management style. You have 24 hours to leave the organization. And if you don't comply with this decision by Washington, we have ways to retaliate against you." Bustany sat dumbfounded as Bolton paused. Bolton looked at Bustany directly once again and finished, "We know where your kids live. You have two sons in New York. This is the kind of anti-hero tough talk that Trump respects. But as the world, Bolton, alone and as a significant spoke in the Cheney wheel, has spent decades damaging the American reputation abroad. He is the ugly American stereotype so bandied about in foreign literature and film. 5. The face of American hypocrisy. Bolton is the face of what liberal and libertarian foreign policy analysts see as the hypocritical policies of American foreign policy. While challenging that Americans can be tried in international criminal courts, he favors unfriendly African leaders being tried in the same courts. He favors stronger nuclear inspection policies around the globe, but then says that any random international inspections to American nuclear sites would threaten the security of the country. When the Russian hacking story first broke, Bolton called it an act of war, again pulling the war card from his pocket quicker than a Vegas whale. When he was chosen for an appointment to the Trump administration, it had become a witch hunt. He also favors on-site American monitoring of foreign elections, which he, of course, does not see as an act of war. The fact of the matter is that Bolton should have never had a position within Trump's administration. Trump campaigned against a deep state entity that he swore was working against his campaign. Yet, after his election, he began replacing his original nominees with career statists bent on expanding America's military reach. It may be that Bolton appeals to Trump's worst personal instincts, the rigid ideologue who talks tough and threatens tougher. Bolton may also be one of the few who morphs Trump's tirades and tongue lashings into tangible policies, dangerous, costly policies, but policies, nonetheless. It is because Bolton bends Trump's worst reflexive outbursts into hawkish, neoconservative benchmarks that he remains a danger to the country and should be put out of the administration. Candidate adopts anti-war platform. Presidential hopeful Tulsi Gabbard rejects interventionism, and the media is killing her for it. By Philip Giraldi. Voters looking ahead to 2020 are being bombarded with soundbites from the 20-plus Democratic would-be candidates. That Joe Biden is apparently leading the pack according to opinion polls should come as no surprise, as he stands for nothing, apart from being the establishment favorite who will tirelessly work to support the status quo. The most interesting candidate is undoubtedly Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, Hawaii, who is a fourth-term congresswoman from Hawaii, where she was born and raised. She is also the real deal on national security, having been there and done it through service as an officer with the Hawaiian National Guard on a combat deployment in Iraq. Though in Congress full-time, she still performs her guard duty, Gabbard's own military experience notwithstanding. She gives every indication of being honestly anti-war. In the speech announcing her candidacy, she pledged to focus on the issue of war and peace to end the regime, change wars that have taken far too many lives and undermined our security by strengthening terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, She referred to the danger posed by blundering into a possible nuclear war and indicated her dismay over what appears to be a re-emergence of the Cold War. In a recent interview with Fox News's Tucker Carlson, Gabbard doubled down on her anti-war credentials, telling the host that war with Iran would be devastating, adding, "I know where this path leads us, and I'm concerned because the American people don't seem to be prepared for how devastating and costly such a war would be. So, what we are facing is, essentially, a war that has no front lines, total chaos, engulfs the whole region, is not contained within Iran or Iraq but would extend to Syria and Lebanon and Israel across the region, setting us up in a situation where, in Iraq, we lost over 4,000 of my brothers and sisters in uniform. A war with Iran would take far more American lives, it would cost more civilian lives across the region, not to speak of the fact that this would cost trillions of taxpayer dollars coming out of our pockets to go and pay for this endless war that begs the question as a soldier, what are we fighting for? What does victory look like? What is the mission?" Gabbard, and also Carlson, did not hesitate to name names among those pushing for war, one of which is spelled with B-O-L-T-O-N. She then asked, "How does a war with Iran serve the best interest of the American people of the United States?" And the fact is, it does not. It better serves the interest of people like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin, Bibi Netanyahu and Saudi Arabia who are trying to push us into this war with Iran, clearly not afraid to challenge the full gamut of establishment politics. Gabbard had previously called for an end to the illegal war to overthrow the Syrian government, also observing that the war to overthrow Assad is counterproductive because it actually helps ISIS and other Islamic extremists achieve their goal of overthrowing the Syrian government of Assad and taking control of all of Syria, which will simply increase human suffering in the region, exacerbate the refugee crisis, and pose a greater threat to the world. She then backed up her words with action by secretly arranging for a personal trip to Damascus in 2017 to meet with, among others, President Bashar al-Assad, saying it was important to meet adversaries if you are serious about pursuing peace. She made her own assessment of the situation in Syria now favors pulling U.S. troops out of the country as well as ending American interventions for regime change in the region. In 2015, Gabbard supported President Barack Obama's nuclear agreement with Iran, and in 2016 she backed Bernie Sanders' anti-war candidacy. More recently, she has criticized President Donald Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last May, she criticized Israel for shooting unarmed protesters in Gaza, a very bold step indeed given the power of the Israel lobby. Gabbard could well be the only genuine anti-war candidate that might truly be electable in the past 50 years, and that is why the war party is out to get her. 2 weeks ago, the Daily Beast displayed a headline, "Tulsi Gabbard's campaign is being boosted by Putin apologists." The article also had a sub-headline, "The Hawaii Congresswoman is quickly becoming the top candidate for Democrats who think the Russian leader is misunderstood." The obvious smear job was picked up by ABC's George Stephanopoulos, television's best-known Hillary Clinton clone, who brought it up in an interview with Gabbard shortly thereafter. He asked whether Gabbard was softer on Putin than were some of the other candidates. Gabbard answered, "It's unfortunate that you're citing that article, George, because it's a whole lot of fake news." Politico then reported the exchange and wrote, "Fake news is a favorite phrase of President Donald Trump," putting the ball back in Gabbard's court rather than criticizing Stephanopoulos's pointless question. Soon thereafter, CNN produced its own version of Tulsi the Russophile, observing that Gabbard was using a Trump expression to attack the credibility of negative coverage. Gabbard responded, "Stephanopoulos shamelessly implied that because I oppose going to war with Russia, I'm not a loyal American, but a Putin puppet. It just shows what absurd lengths warmongers in the media will go to try to destroy the reputation of anyone who dares oppose their warmongering." Gabbard had attracted other enemies prior to the Stephanopoulos attack. Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept described how NBC News published a widely distributed story on February 1, claiming that experts who track websites and social media linked to Russia have seen stirrings of a possible campaign of support for Hawaii Democrat Tulsi Gabbard. but the expert cited by NBC turned out to be a firm, New Knowledge, which was exposed by no less than the New York Times for falsifying Russian troll accounts for the Democratic Party in the Alabama Senate race to suggest that the Kremlin was interfering in that election. According to Greenwald, the group ultimately behind this attack on Gabbard is the Alliance for Securing Democracy, ASD, which sponsors a tool called Hamilton 68, a news intelligence net checker that claims to track Russian efforts to disseminate disinformation. The ASD website advises, securing democracy is a global necessity. ASD was set up in 2017 by the usual neocon crowd with funding from the Atlantic Council and anti-Russian German Marshall Fund. It is loaded with a full complement of Zionists and interventionist globalists, to include Michael Chertoff, Michael McFaul, Michael Morell, Corey Shake, and Bill Kristol. It claims, innocently, to be a bipartisan transatlantic national security advocacy group that seeks to identify and counter efforts by Russia to undermine democracies in the United States and Europe, but it is actually itself a major source of disinformation. No doubt stories headlined Tulsi Gabbard communist stooge in the works somewhere in the mainstream media. The establishment politicians and their media component have difficulty in understanding just how much they are despised for their mendacity and unwillingness to support policies that would truly benefit the American people, but they are well able to dominate press coverage. Given the flood of contrived negativity towards her campaign, it is not clear if Gabbard will ever be able to get her message across, but, for the moment, she seems to be the real thing. A genuine anti-war candidate who is determined to run on that platform. It might just resonate with the majority of Americans who have grown tired of perpetual warfare to spread democracy and other related frauds perpetrated by the band of oligarchs and traitors that run the United States. USS Liberty cover-up proves the power of the Israel lobby. By Paul Craig Roberts earlier this month, the U.S. celebrated the 75th anniversary of D-Day with accolades to the armed forces and thanks to surviving veterans. The country stood strongly with the military, but, June 8, 2 days later, is the 52nd anniversary of a day of shame when Washington turned its back on the U.S. Navy. It was June 8, 1967 when the USS Liberty, a surveillance ship stationed off the coast of Egypt, was attacked by Israeli fighter aircraft and torpedo boats. The Israelis were unable to sink the Liberty but managed to kill 34 American sailors and wound 174. 70% of the crew were casualties of the Israeli attack. The White House, fearing the Israel lobby, prevented the U.S. Navy from going to the defense of the Liberty, thus sacrificing American lives, and further dishonored the U.S. Navy by ordering A.D.M. McCain, father of the late Senator John McCain, R.R.S., to orchestrate a cover-up. The surviving crew were threatened with court-martial and imprisonment if they spoke about the event. It was 20 years before one of the surviving officers wrote a book about the greatest act of shame the U.S. government ever inflicted on the U.S. military. In 2003, 36 years after the Israeli attack on the Liberty, ADM Tom Maurer, former Chief of Naval Operations and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, convene the Independent Commission of Inquiry into the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. The recall of military rescue support aircraft while the Liberty was under attack, and the subsequent cover-up by the United States government. The commission consisted of Maurer, General Raymond Davis, former Assistant Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, Rear ADM Merlin Staring, former Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, and James Akins, former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. You can read the report online, at Wikisource, for example, by searching for the Maurer report. The report is devastating. Among the report's conclusions, these stand out: that due to the influence of Israel's powerful supporters in the United States, the White House deliberately covered up the facts of this attack from the American people; that due to continuing pressure by the pro-Israel lobby in the United States, this attack remains the only serious naval incident that has never been thoroughly investigated by Congress. To this day, no surviving crew member has been permitted to officially and publicly testify about the attack. That there has been an official cover-up without precedent in American naval history. The existence of such a cover-up is now supported by statements of Rear Admiral Merlin Sterring, USN, RET, former Judge Advocate General of the Navy, and Captain Ward Boston, USN, RET, the Chief Counsel to the Navy's 1967 Court of Inquiry of Liberty attack, that the truth about Israel's attack and subsequent White House cover-up continues to be officially concealed from the American people to the present day and is a national disgrace, that a danger to our national security exists whenever our elected officials are willing to subordinate American interests to those of any foreign nation, and specifically are unwilling to challenge Israel's interests when they conflict with American interests. This policy, evidenced by the failure to defend USS Liberty in the subsequent official cover-up of the Israeli attack, endangers the safety of Americans and the security of the United States. After interviewing many of the survivors, Captain Ward Boston, who was assigned to cover up the attack and afterward repudiated the cover-up, and Bill Knutson, the executive officer of the USS America fighter squadron that was called back on orders from the White House, and lengthy discussions with Moore, my former colleague at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, I have written about the Israeli attack on the Liberty a number of times. My conclusion, all who discount the influence of Israel on the U.S. government are ignorant fools. Trump fights back against accusers, by Donald Jeffries. Those who created and promulgated the absurd Russiagate conspiracy theory may soon find themselves under legal scrutiny. Christopher Steele, the British ex-spy whose name is attached to the infamous dossier that recklessly accused Donald Trump of highly objectionable acts, is one of those worried about the Justice Department's, Dodge, Inspector General's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act abuse investigation. Matthew Rosenberg, affiliated with both CNN and the New York Times, reported that those close to Steele confirm he is willing to meet with the Inspector General's investigators. During a recent appearance on CNN, Rosenberg noted that Steele is also incredibly concerned and obsessed that this investigation is going to throw him under the bus. Rosenberg explained that Steele's perspective was, "Look, I was working on this dossier other people were paying for, that the Democrats were paying for. I saw things that seemed frightening to me and alarming, and I went to old contacts at the FBI to tell them. I wasn't a paid source in this case." That's his view of it. Steele's dossier was not only fodder for celebrities creating toilet humor about the president but was a key rationale for the surveillance warrants against former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, under the aforementioned Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. Steele, it should be remembered, worked for Fusion GPS, which received funding from the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign and the Democratic National Committee, a crucial fact hidden from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Anxious not to become a patsy or scapegoat, in Rosenberg's words, Steele was simply helping them out, and what they did with it, whether they misused it in a FISA or whatever they did, he had nothing to do with that. Attorney General William Barr earlier this year stated that he expected Inspector General Michael Horowitz's investigation to be wrapped up by the end of May or June. Sean Hannity reported this week that sources were telling him Barr may already have a copy of the Inspector General's report on the FISA abuse investigation. If Horowitz speaks with Steele soon, it is unclear what that will mean for the inquiry that was thought to be winding down. Barr is also said to be looking into a broader investigation on the origins of the Russian collusion theory, with U.S. Attorney John Durham to head it. Horowitz's internal Dodge report is expected to focus on potential political bias by FBI agents who were at the center of the Russia investigation. This report could not only impede Democratic efforts to impeach Trump but provide him with a powerful weapon in his efforts to portray the Russiagate probe as part of an attempt at a coup against him. Rep. Jamie Raskin, DMD, epitomized the attitude of Democrats, saying in an interview, "Their whole point is to go on a wild goose chase and then to create a chain of implausible connections that show that the special counsel report, and what we're doing, is somehow fruit of the poisonous tree. It's absurd." Democrats are planning to launch an aggressive public relations campaign, revolving around publicizing what they claim is evidence, contained in Mueller's report, that Trump sought to thwart or otherwise shut down his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. This strategy of essentially arguing the case for Trump's impeachment could be significantly impacted by the counter-investigations from the administration. Trump recently gave Barr broad authority to declassify evidence regarding how the Russia probe began. Democrats reacted predictably to this. "I don't think it will throw us off track, but it will certainly give Republicans ammunition to try to divert attention away from the specifics of the Mueller investigation," said Rep. Hank Johnson, DCA. "It's a profound breach of confidence that the legislative branch has in the executive branch, and a profound disruption in the intelligence apparatus worldwide." Republicans have long argued that attempts to investigate things like Trump's personal finances are politically motivated and an abuse of congressional authority, because Inspector General Horowitz is known for calling balls and strikes. Any validity that he offers in his report that substantiates some of the things that conservative members have been saying for some time will change the narrative overnight, stated Rep. Mark Meadows, RNC, one of Trump's top allies in Congress. "Just like Democrats waited for the Mueller report to come out, they should wait for the IG's report to come out, because the IG's report will actually go at the root of improper motivations on the investigation." Horowitz is not considered a partisan figure, and last year issued a report that concluded the FBI's handling of a 2016 probe into Hillary Clinton had reflected no political bias. Whether the findings of Horowitz's new probe also please the deep state remains to be seen. Ghosts of Fallujah haunting America. U.S. legislator admits his Marine Corps unit may have killed hundreds of civilians. By Richard Walker. The admission by Rep. Duncan Hunter, R. Calif., that his Marine Corps unit may have killed hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in the city of Fallujah in Iraq in April 2004 once again raises the question of whether U.S. forces committed war crimes and used chemical and other unnamed weapons during major battles in Iraq that year. Hunter was an artillery officer in what became known as the First Battle of Fallujah in April 2004, a city known for its beautiful, ancient mosques 30 miles from Baghdad. It was transformed into a war zone when protesters killed four Blackwater contractors and hung their bodies from a bridge. An operation was launched to find those responsible, but it developed into a full-scale engagement. What is remarkable about this first battle of Fallujah is that it did not last long, so the revelation by Hunter encourages additional scrutiny since it was not the battle that garnered the most controversy. "Nevertheless, we have now learned that one artillery unit, by Hunter's reckoning, may have killed hundreds of innocent civilians. It is worth noting that there is no credible official figure for civilian casualties because the U.S. commanders in the Pentagon play down the killing of civilians in the Iraq conflict, though some estimates place deaths in the Mideast country at between 500,000 and 1,000,000. While the first battle was bloody, the second Battle of Fallujah, in November 2004, was the one that we at American Free Press focused on most, believing correctly that the mainstream media was relying too much on official accounts of what transpired and was being denied the truth. AFP followed the story conscientiously, and we continue to do so in succeeding years. We were confident our reporting would be proved accurate and that new facts would emerge to confirm the claims we made that Marines used chemical weapons and depleted uranium munitions. The U.S. military suffered 71 dead and over 250 injured in the Fallujah battles, leading to comparisons being made with some of the major exchanges of the Vietnam War. In November 2004, Fallujah was sealed off from the outside world and quickly became a free-fire zone. This would be the second Battle of Fallujah. There were many Iraqi fighters in the city, but there were civilians, too, who did not want to leave or had been unable to escape. The battle was akin to what one might associate with the Second World War battle for Leningrad, with many snipers on both sides. In Fallujah, however, Marine Corps commanders had more firepower than the Iraqi fighters and used it to devastating effect. Some might argue that they used it with abandon. Within a month, in what was dubbed Operation Phantom Fury, 36,000 homes were leveled, as well as 60 schools and 65 mosques. The city resembled a wasteland at the time, and later, AFP reported that the Marines used white phosphorus bombs similar to ones the Israelis used later in Gaza, but it was the widespread deployment of depleted uranium, DU, munitions that was to have lasting human damage, in 2004, and for several years afterwards, the Pentagon admitted having used white phosphorus, a chemical weapon that should not be used against civilians but denied that DU munitions were on the battlefield. The truth emerged in 2010, however, when a British scientist and his team revealed that levels of radiation illnesses in Fallujah were comparable to, if not higher, than those found in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atom bombs were detonated there in 1945. It is still believed that other chemical weapons were used in Fallujah by the Marine Corps, but never identified. For example, aside from evidence of radiation, traces of mercury and other poisonous substances were found that could not be linked to known weapons. The British scientific report entitled Cancer, Infant Mortality, and Birth Sex Ratio in Fallujah, Iraq 2005-2009 confirmed that DU was in shells and also in bullets that were fired in large, unreported quantities, causing radiation contamination. DU's effects can last for a long period and resulted over time in physical deformities among children. The DU bullets were reported to have cut through walls like a hot knife through butter. The Pentagon has been reluctant to confirm whether experimental weapons were used on that battlefield. Daniel D. Petrus, a conservative columnist, believes America has learned little from the Iraq War, even though most Americans believe it was a disaster that caused thousands of American lives and tens of thousands of casualties. He offers opinions on what our leaders should do before going to war, but perhaps his best piece of advice to them is deliver a case to the American people about why military action is appropriate and make them fully aware of what can go wrong. He knows, like the rest of us, that in Iraq everything that could go wrong did go wrong, especially in Fallujah. Unpunished war crimes, suicidal neocon foreign policy is the real war crime, by Dr. Ron Paul Rep. Duncan Hunter, our caliph, found himself in hot water recently over comments he made in defense of Navy SEAL Edward Gallagher, who faces war crimes charges over his alleged conduct while serving in combat overseas. Gallagher is charged with stabbing a 15-year-old ISIS member while in custody, of taking photos posing with the corpse of the teen, and with killing several civilians. Defending Gallagher recently, Hunter put his own record up next to the SEAL to suggest that he's an elected congressman who has done worse things in battle than Gallagher. That's where Hunter's defense earned him some perhaps unwanted attention. While participating in the First Battle of Fallujah in early 2004, by Hunter's own account, he and his fellow soldiers killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children. They fired mortars into the city and killed at random. In the sanitized world of U.S. mainstream media reporting on U.S. wars overseas, we do not hear about non-combatants being killed by Americans. How many times has there been any reporting on the birth defects that Iraqis continue to suffer in the aftermath of U.S. attacks with horrific weapons like depleted uranium and white phosphorus? Hunter described his philosophy when fighting in Iraq. You go in fast and hard, you kill people, you hit them in the face, and then you get out. We're going to hurt you and then we're going to leave. And if you want to be nice to America, we'll be nice to you. If you don't want to be nice to us, we're going to slap you again. This shows how much Hunter does not understand about war. When he speaks of hitting people in the face until they are nice to America, he doesn't seem to realize that the people of Fallujah, and all of Iraq, never did a thing to the United States to deserve that hit in the face. The war was launched on the basis of lies and cooked up intelligence by many of the people who are serving in the current administration. And that brings us to the real war criminals. Hunter and his fellow soldiers may have killed hundreds of innocent civilians and even felt justified. Their superior officers, after all, established the rules of engagement. Above those superior officers, going up and beyond to the policymakers, the lie was sold to the American people to justify a war of choice against a country that could not have threatened us if it wanted to. Vice President Dick Cheney knew what he was doing when he kept returning to the CIA headquarters, strong-arming analysts to make the intelligence fit the chosen policy. John Bolton and the other neocons knew what they were doing when they made claims about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction they knew were false. The Pentagon's Office of Special Plans played its role in selling the lie. So did the media. Gallagher will face trial and possibly jail for his actions. Hunter may even face punishment, though perhaps only at the ballot box, for his admitted crimes. But until those at the top who continue to lie and manipulate us into war for their own gain face justice, the real criminals will continue to go free and we will continue pursuing a suicidal neocon foreign policy. U.S. citizens band together, privately fund border wall, by John Friend. As President Donald Trump continues to fail to fulfill one of his key campaign promises to build a wall along the southern U.S. border to protect America against the ongoing invasion of third world migrants, private U.S. citizens are taking the initiative themselves. Brian Kalfage, a combat veteran who served 2-2 in Iraq with the Air Force, helped establish We Build the Wall, Incorporated, along with former Trump advisor Steve Bannon. The nonprofit organization set up a GoFundMe page late last year in an effort to raise funds from private U.S. citizens to help finance construction of a border wall along key sectors of the porous U.S.-Mexico border, where illegal immigrants from a variety of countries continue to pour through. Kalfage is a triple amputee veteran who received the Purple Heart Award for his service in Iraq. He, like many Americans who voted for Trump, is determined to see a border wall built to help protect the U.S. border and hinder illegal immigration. As a veteran who has given so much, three limbs, I feel deeply invested to this nation to ensure future generations have everything we have today, Kalfage stated on the GoFundMe page for We Build a Wall, Incorporated, which as AFP goes to press has generated over $23.8 million in donations since it was established. Too many Americans have been murdered by illegal aliens and too many illegals are taking advantage of the United States taxpayers with no means of ever contributing to our society. I have grandparents who immigrated to America legally. They did it the correct way, and it's time we uphold our laws and get this wall built. Donations large and small began rolling in almost immediately, and picked up big time over Memorial Day weekend, when construction of the privately funded wall began. According to the Epoch Times, the average donation received by We Build the Wall, Incorporated was $67, and roughly $2 million was raised by $5 donations, demonstrating that many Americans want to see a wall built, even if they have to pay for it with private funds. I realized that everyone can have an impact, and if you think you can't have an impact, then you're wrong, because everyone who donated had a big impact, Kalfage explained to the Epoch Times. The recently completed half-mile section of the border wall was constructed near Sunland Park, NM, in an area known to have long been exploited by illegal aliens, human and drug traffickers, and others attempting to illegally enter the United States. According to Mike Fury, the director of construction operations for We Build a Wall, Incorporated, who has overseen the project, the barrier will be a tremendous asset to U.S. Border Patrol agents. We actually, literally, in this first half mile, going up a 31% grade, have cut off 19 drug trails, walking trails, and trafficking trails, Fury noted. Kalfage and his organization have big plans for the future and hope to continue to generate donation revenue to fund their other planned projects. We have made a list of every single landowner on the U.S. border, and we have constantly been going down the list and making contact with each one, networking and figuring out who fits the mold for what we want to do, Kalfage stated. Currently, we have about 10 properties in the pipeline. After this, news broke earlier in June that the International Boundary and Water Commission, IWBC, an agency that regulates waterway issues between the United States and Mexico, ordered that a gate built into the recently completed wall be left open for officials to access certain watersheds. Kalfage and his group protested this decision, and recently announced on Twitter that the border wall and gate are secure again after consulting with IBWC officials. The efforts of Kalfage and thousands of Americans who have supported his projects are a testament to the seriousness of the border crisis. Millions of illegal aliens, including countless minors, have flooded the U.S. in recent years, often with fraudulent asylum claims, fake paperwork, and little to no money or skills necessary to compete in an advanced economy. The vast majority are not appearing for their court hearing to adjudicate their asylum claims, and customs and immigration agencies are overwhelmed by the sheer number of individuals seeking to enter the United States. If the Trump administration and congressional representatives continue to fail to secure the U.S. border and address the border crisis, hardworking and dedicated American patriots will step in and get the job done. If there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my child may have peace. Thomas Paine, The American Crisis, Number 1, December 19, 1776, and Trouble There's. Last year, American Free Press had nearly every form of electronic payment taken away by the big banks. Every time we'd get one back, they canceled another. It's been a struggle, but one we must win to survive. However, as Mark Twain once quipped, reports of our demise are greatly exaggerated. And, to quote another great American, Thomas Paine, these are the times that try men's souls. Know this, however, no matter what the billion dollar power brokers do to murder American Free Press, the truth cannot be silenced, and neither will we. Those bonus-sucking executives and ultra-rich anti-American pressure groups behind the attempts to shut down AFP will fail. We know they will fail because we have something that they don't have on their side, the truth. As long as we draw breath, the staff of American Free Press will not give up our mission to counter the lies and misinformation of the controlled corporate media. But the battle will be tough. We know that. Luckily, we have a secret weapon, our fellow Americans. Even now, people whom we don't know but who have heard about the outrageous financial attacks on AFP have called to offer us words of unwavering support. But this time, words will not be enough. AFP continues to need financial help from those who understand that we are the largest of the remaining real news newspapers. It's why we are being targeted. Can you imagine a world without AFP? Who would fill the void? Could they be trusted? Will some government front group emerge to replace AFP if it falters? We hope never to see that day, and we won't have to if average Americans continue to assist our efforts with cash donations and street-level support. We need that help more than ever, and America deserves an independent media. AFP is more than a newspaper. It is the strongest, loudest, independent voice for the American middle class. Please use the form of right to help in any way you can. Let's show the enemies of free speech that they have underestimated your love of our God-given right to say and think what we please. Rest assured, there are thousands more like you out there, people unwilling to allow freedom of speech to die without a fight. But the doctor says that free speech in America is on life support. We believe it can be saved if enough people come to understand the importance of this moment in time in American history. Never before in our past have we seen so many people with alternative viewpoints persecuted and harassed with the goal of silencing them. Should AFP be run out of business by the compliant minions of the deep state, one of this nation's great defenders of free speech would be muzzled, never to appear again, in print or the internet. And that, my friends, would be a crime of historic proportions. We have plans, but we need your help. Please see the form at right to find out how you can help us weather this all-out assault by the fat cat power brokers and well-heeled pressure groups threatened by open discussion of their un-American agendas. Sincerely, Paul Angel, AFP Vice President.